Good. Okay. It's the week of Bereshit. This, by the way, is a little bit of an opportunity we don't always get, because often we don't meet this week because Yom Tov is midweek, and either we're just coming back or else it's actually Yom Tov. And we usually start with Noach. So starting with Parshat Bereshit is kind of a gift. And to be honest, several times in the past, I've stolen from either Parshat Noach or from before Sukkot to do a little Bereshit stuff, because there's just so much great stuff in the Parsha. So what I'd like to do is actually do a little leapfrogging through the Parsha through several texts, two of which are contiguous and one which is distant from it, which I think connect to each other and are informative about a whole slew of things. And I'm going to start with the end. We're going to spend all of our time in the text of the Tanakh, with the exception of this opening line. The Gemara you see it in source one, the Gemara in Chulin has a series of these bizarre questions. Moshe min HaTorah minayin, it's like Haman min HaTorah minayin, Esther min HaTorah minayin, you know, and now Haman and Esther min HaTorah minayin is kind of a good question, because neither one of them is in the Torah. So where do we find a hint in the story of the Torah to the story of Purim? Haman, Hamina Eitz Minarat, Haster Astir Panai, beautiful. And then the Gemara asks this bizarre question, which is Moshe min HaTorah minayin. Where do we find a hint to Moshe in the Torah? Now, this is really a bizarre question. It reminds me of the question at the beginning of Masachet Makot, where Rish Lakish is quoted as saying, Eidim zomim min HaTorah minayin. How do we know, like a hint to the idea of conspiring witnesses? And the Gemara immediately attacks it. What kind of question is that? Behediktiv. It's written explicitly. Vasita lo kasher zamam lasot lachiv. So then the Gemara fixes the question and says, no, what I mean is, where's a hint to the idea that Eidim zomim under certain circumstances get makot? Okay, fine. But here the Gemara doesn't do this. The Gemara asks the question, Moshe min HaTorah minayin, where's a hint to Moshe in the Torah? Which, of course, is very bizarre, because Moshe is the central human figure in the Torah, without a question. And it's his death, it's the end of the Torah. We read about it a few days ago. And so to say Moshe min HaTorah minayin is a bizarre question. The Gemara doesn't protest the question, and the Gemara gives a really strange answer. When I asked this question around the house, the answer that I got immediately from all members of the family was, Min ha-mayim mishitihu. They quoted Bat Paro as saying, I drew him from the water, that's Moshe, etc. Beautiful. The Gemara says something else. Moshe min HaTorah minayin, and the answer is Bishagam hu basar. Now, Bishagam hu basar is a strange phrase which has the commentators confounded, and we'll see the context of it in a few minutes. But what's the trick is that Bishagam, if you count up the numerical value, the gematria of the word Bishagam, it comes out to the same as Moshe. And by the way, this one's easy, because you got a mem and a shin, that's the, right, and the bet and gimel are equal to the hay, so it's an easy math thing. Fine. So is the Gemara really trying to tell us that because the word Bishagam, with its unusual usage and possibly problematic meaning, is Moshe because the same gematria? I mean, give me a break. That's very strange. So we're going to leave this question, and we're going to end with answering this question, or at least suggesting an answer to this question. Rashi on the spot observes that, after all, Moshe lived to be 120 years old. And that's the reason that this Bishagam is in there. And so I'm going to already leapfrog ahead to the last text, which is on the second page, and you'll see where Bishagam and the 120 years comes in, but we're going to not analyze this text yet. We're going to come back to it. The very end of our parasha, and I'll be honest with you, this is what got me started on this shiur, is reading this piece and saying, what the heck is going on? Now, we ask this question every year, what the heck is going on? But again, most years we don't have time to breathe, so you're certainly not to ask this question. When man began increasing over the face of the earth, uvanot yoldu lahem, and they had daughters. Vayiru v'nei ha'elohim et b'nota adam, the b'nei ha'elohim, whatever that means, angels, powerful men, sons of leaders, saw the daughters of man, kitovoteno, they saw that they were good, good looking, is that what it means? They took women from all the ones they chose. Now, is this a good thing, a bad thing, or a neutral thing? It seems like it's a bad thing because God responds and says, Vayomer Adonai, Lo yadon ruchi v'adam leolam, b'shagam hu basar. There's our b'shagam. And God says, Lo yadon ruchi v'adam leolam, which may mean, my spirit will no longer reside with man forever, or it may mean something else. And then the explanation seems to be b'shagam hu basar. So the simple way of reading that, which is not at all simple, is to say, because he's also flesh. So my spirit will not stay with him forever because he's also flesh, which seems to indicate that this past story was a story of corruption of the flesh. And as a result of that, a diminution or a challenge to God's spirit in man. So God says, okay, from now on, I'm not going to leave my spirit with man forever, which seems to say that at this point, God is decreeing death. You know, till now, there was no death. Of course, that's not exactly true, because if you kill somebody, they died. Hevel, that already happened. And we already had the whole table of generations, each passage which end with Vayamot. He lived this long and he died. And of course, the very first command to man was don't eat from that tree. And if you do, on the day you do, you're gonna die. So what does this mean? And then he says, Vayu Yamav Me'av Esrim Shana. His days will be 120 years. All right? Which simple read of it is that God is saying, I'm going to limit man's life to 120 years, which from our perspective, of course, is record breaking. But from perspective of the rest of earlier part of Bereishit is a real limitation. So at first glance, it sounds like God is saying, you know what, having man live this long is not a good idea. There's too much collision of flesh and spirit, and therefore I'm going to limit his life to only 120 years. Okay, first of all, what's the rationale behind that? Kind of strange. Second question is, it's not true, because after this, we have Noah, and Noah lives till 950 years, and we have all these people living till these excessive years. And that includes, by the way, Abraham living to 175, Yitzchak living to 180, Yaakov living to 147. So 120 is not some sort of limit that was enforced at any point here. So what is this referring to? So right away, you can sense there's some sort of Moshe connection. And that seems to be what the Gemara is doing. B'shagam is allusion to Moshe. And Rashi on the spot says, because Moshe lived 120 years. But what's underneath it? And now the last question I'm going to ask on this passage, and we're not going to answer until we get back, is who cares? Now, by the way, the who cares question is a critical question that every parshan asks. Anybody who's commenting on the Torah asks the question, who cares? Now, if there's a mitzvah, the answer is we care because we have to do it. If there's a story that's an etiology of a mitzvah, like the background, like the story of Yaakov wrestling with the... So I understand we need it to understand why we do a particular mitzvah. If you tell me a story about Yaakov sleeping somewhere and renaming the place Beit El, I need to know that story because I need to know why Beit El is a holy place and why people later built a mikdash there and why it's called Beit El at all. Okay, why do I need this story? What does this story give me? It gives me nothing. And just to finish it off, we'll read the last pasuk. Hanefilim hayu v'aretz bayamim ahem. The Nephilim, and I don't know what the Nephilim are, but they seem to be, from the rest of the Pasuk, some sort of powerful people, were in the land in those days. The Gam Acharechein, even afterwards, Asher Yavo, B'nei HaElohim, Abnot Adam. And here we have these B'nei HaElohim again showing up and having relations with the daughters of man. And again, the whole thing is mysterious. The Aldulahem, and the daughters gave birth from these men. And it seems like the Nephilim were the result of that. Hema Giborim Hashem Olam Anshei Hashem. These are the heroes from the men of note. A stranger story you can't find. I don't think in Bereishit you can find a stranger story. And the very next thing that happens after the new parsha is God sees that man is evil and that man is doing terribly. And God says, I regret creating man. I'm going to wipe man out. And that leads to the flood. So for all of these reasons, we look at this story, context, God's reaction, the limitation, and we see whatever happened here must have been a bad thing. What was the bad thing? We don't know. How do we reckon the 120 years? We don't know. How do we reconcile that with the fact that people lived for much longer than 120 years, well after this? We don't know. But here's what we are. And I put a few of the questions here after this particular parasha, and we'll come back, take a look at it. For the last piece on this parasha, just look at source six for a second. Source six is like the most succinct way of presenting the whole palette of Mefarshim, because the Bnei HaElohim in this story are broadly seen by most Mefarshim as being the children of leaders, meaning there were big leaders, there were judges or kings or rulers, and their children came and did this thing with the girls. And so you see it in the Midrash Haggadah, it's a later Midrash on Bereishit, by Ruben Elohim Bnei HaDayanim. Now the earlier Midrash tells us that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai used to curse anybody who read this as Bnei Elohaya, meaning as angels. And he said, God forbid, these aren't angels, these are just people, and these are corrupt children of corrupt leaders, etc. However, the Midrash points out, V'yeshomrim malachim mamash. Some people say the Bnei Elohim really were angels. And this is a story about angels having relations with mortal women. And think about all of the pagan associations that we have with that sort of stuff. And the result of that were these sort of monstrous humans and all of that. Okay. A difficult passage in and of itself. Let's go back to the beginning. I say go back to the beginning because I believe that this passage is part of a sequence of passages that course through Bereishit and speak to a sort of evolution of man, not necessarily good evolution, but an evolution of man. Let's see. And the word that I put on top, arur acharei arur, curse after a curse, is kind of the subtext in this whole piece. The other piece is that you notice in the subtitle I gave it is tracing man's steps from Eden to the banks of the Jordan. And you see, how do we get to the banks of the Jordan with this? But I'm going to put out a premise here, which I've shared numerous times, and I think is easily argued to be a valid premise, which is anything that is in the Torah has to have meaning for the generation of the Torah. It is our job to find meaning in it after the generation of the Torah. And certainly when it comes to the legal texts and the critical history, like the history of Yetziat Mitzrayim and Matan Torah, that's something that speaks to every generation easily. That's not a stretch. Sometimes there are particular stories like Avram going down to Egypt and his interactions with Paro, or Yitzchak's interactions with the Plishtim, where we have to dig a little harder. Sorry for the pun, but that was intentional, in order to try to understand what the significance is and what the message is. And that the Rishonim do in different ways and the Midrashim do in lots of ways to try to identify it. So let's keep that in mind. Any passage that's here has got to be a passage that speaks to us, that is a message that is significant first and foremost for the generation that left Egypt, the generation that got the Torah, and it also speaks to us in some way. Okay, so let's start near the beginning. After the first program of creation, which is the first chapter and the next three verses, what we like to refer to as Maaseh Bereishit, but according to at least some opinions in Chazal, was only the ideal Maaseh Bereishit, but not the one that actually happened. We hear the story about the creation of man. Now you'll notice that in this creation of man, there is a word that plays back and forth. Source 2, Ela todot ha-shamayim va'aretz b'hib baram, b'yom asot Adonai Elohim eretz v'shamayim. Notice that the word used for earth is eretz, right? Eretz as opposed to shamayim, heaven. Nothing had grown yet. Why? God had not yet made it rain on the land. And suddenly a new word shows up, which is adama, a different word for land. And the association here is very clear because it's a play on the word Adam. Adam is called Adam because he comes from the Adama. That's the what we hear here in this text. And therefore, the play on words, Adam, Avodata Adama. But we'll see that the word Adama keeps coming up in this story and in later stories and seems to reflect something else about the earth. The Eid Yal, we're going to come back to the word Eid. Eid is like a cloud, a condensation. Yalemina Aret. So the first thing God did was to have some condensation start. V'ishkad kol Pnei Adama. It started raining and it rained over all and watered the Pnei Adama. So you picture sort of a parched land and then suddenly a cloud rises over it, it rains on it, and now the land is drenched. V'yitzer Adonai Elohim et ha'adam afar min ha'adama. And so then God forms man, Adam, earth from dirt from the Adama. And again, Adama, not Aretz. V'yipach be'aflav nishmat chayim, he blows the spirit of life into him. V'yi ha'adam l'nefesh chaya. And man is now alive. V'yita Adonai Elohim gan be'eden mikedem. And now God plants a garden inside Eden to the east. V'yasim sham et ha'adam asher yetzar. And he now puts Adam into the garden, which means man was not created in the garden. Man's created somewhere else. And then God creates this garden. And God then puts Adam in the garden. Now notice, in this little story about the creation of man, the word Adam and Adama are used together seven times. Clearly the key word and the switch from Aretz to Adama seems to be shifting the emphasis. So it works very well for having seven mentions of it. And then there's an eighth allusion to it because instead of saying Anan or Av, a cloud rises from the ground to water, the Torah uses the very uncommon word Eid, Aleph Dalid, which if you look at it is Adam minus a Mem. So it's as if the Torah is hinting that there's this suddenly proliferation of Adama stuff all over the story. Adama and Adam and Eid all over the place. Okay, so we've now shifted to Adama. Now what's the difference between Eretz and Adama? So Eretz is a geographic identity. Eretz is a political identity. Eretz Mitzrayim, Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan. Adama speaks much more to agriculture. Adama speaks to the land as a source of growth. So man is pulled from the Adama, and fruit will grow from the Adama, and things will grow from the Adama when it has rained on the Adama, and Adam is there to work the Adama. And that seems to be the difference. Now, we know what happens next. Man is alone, and God in this garden has created all sorts of beautiful things, including, of course, Eitz Hadat Tovara and Eitz HaChaim, and God commands man, and then man is lonely. So what people often forget is God's response to man's loneliness was to create animals and try to get animals to be man's companion. That didn't work. God puts man to sleep, and then he creates a woman, and there's a clever play on words with two words that have nothing to do with each other in their cognates, which is ish and isha, but she's an isha because she comes from an ish. Okay, the roots are actually different words, and the two of them are in the garden, and they are in the garden, as we know, unashamed. And then enters the whole story however we're supposed to understand it. You want to take Milton's perspective, you want to take any other perspective. All right. Now, enter source three. Okay. And it's source three, which is the aftermath of the whatever you want to call it, whether it's a sin or whether it's a maturation, however you want to understand. When they ate from the tree, the snake is cursed, the woman is cursed, and now the man. Watch the curse of man. It is unusual. Uli Adam Amar, God speaks to the man and says, Ki shamata l'kol ishtecha. You listen to your wife. Now, that listening to your wife is not necessarily a bad thing. Matter of fact, later on, God actually commands Avram to listen to his wife. But the point is, you listen to your wife as opposed to me. You get on my command in favor of your wife's invitation. You ate from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from. The earth, the adama, the land, is now cursed on your behalf. Now, you are Adam, and you find out that the earth, which you were supposed to work, is now cursed on your behalf. What do you do? What do you do? What does somebody do if they are a ball player and they have a permanent injury to their leg? They find another profession. So we would think, oh, Adam can't be a farmer anymore because the land won't produce for him. So he'll find something else to do. Maybe a hunter. Instead, watch what happens. You are going to eat from the earth for the rest of your life in pain. It will be a pain. You're going to grow thistles and brambles. And you'll eat the grass of the earth. In other words, you're going to grow things. You're going to still be farming, but it's going to be a pain and you're going to have a lot of problems. It's not going to be simple. Now, we get the impression that before this, the relationship between man and the earth was a very simple thing where the earth just grew stuff and man just had to sort of keep an eye on it. And it was all lush and beautiful. And now he's going to have to work it hard. You're going to eat bread by the sweat of your brow, implying that beforehand it was easy. Ad shuvcha el ha'adama, and watch the full circle, till you return to the earth. That's where you were taken from. In other words, all things go back to their source. You came from the earth, you're going to come back to the earth. But your relationship with the earth will not be one of comfort. It will be one of apposition and conflict. You will be in conflict with the earth. Okay? So now, the first step of cursedness is that the land is cursed on account of man. Man will continue to work the earth, and now it will be his enemy. And now it will be a problem. But he doesn't have a choice. Keep that in mind. Man continues to be a farmer. Now, and I know this is going to go against everything we know from anthropology, but not our concern. You'll see where we're going. Vayomer Adonai, I'm skipping to one pasuk. Vayomer Adonai Elohim, hein ha'adam hayah kachad mimeno la'adat tov hara. Now God says, we don't know who he's speaking to, maybe just his own reflection, that man is now like one of us. He knows good and evil. He may take from the tree of life and live forever. We can't have that. What that means is a whole other shiur. But he sends him out of Gan Eden to work the land, which means, let's roll it back. What land was he supposed to work? This is the land he was supposed to work. Meaning he was created in a land somewhere outside of Gan Eden. And he was supposed to work that land. Because we saw from the beginning, it hadn't rained yet, and man wasn't there to work it. He was then brought into the Gan, and a couple of years ago I shared with you Rav Samet's observation that the Gan was like a protective childhood. And then, when he had matured, he was thrown out in order to do his job, which is to work the land. However, because of what had happened, the relationship with the land now was one of conflict, and he's now working the land outside of the Gan, and the land is not going to yield for him as easily. Okay, and now, the very next thing that we read, next section is the next generation. The next generation is Cain and Hevel. Now, I'll take you back to the penultimate song in Oklahoma. If you remember, the last song is the Oklahoma song. The song before that is, "Oh, the farmer and the rancher should be friends." Right? Good, because the farmer and the rancher hate each other. And we're going to see it right now because the farmer and the rancher hating each other starts in Bereishit. It starts in Bereishit. Here we go. V'adam yadad chava yishto, man has relations with his wife. V'atar v'teled et Kayin. She gives birth to a child named Kayin. Evidently, she names it because v'tomer kaniti ishat adonai, I have created a man with God. Okay, beautiful hashkafah. God is a partner in birthing. Beautiful. Vatosef laleret et achiv et havel. She then has another son, and the brother's name is Hevel. Hevel, by the way, means what? Hevel means nothingness, right? And both of these names seem to speak to what's going to happen later on. Hevel is a rancher. He's a herdsman. And Cain is a farmer. By the way, Cain being a farmer means Cain is working his father's fields. Cain is continuing what Adam was doing. Hevel is the one who's, shall we say, broken new ground and has gone into animal husbandry or to farm and to shepherding or ranching. Okay. By the way, one thing to look at is Pasuk Bet is a chiasmus. Aleph and Bet. It has the birth of Cain, then the birth of Hevel, then Hevel's livelihood and Cain's livelihood. So Hevel's in the middle, which means Hevel seems to be the star. Hevel's the important guy here. It seems like that from the way that chiasma typically work. In any case, what happens? Vahimiketz yamim. So after some time, Vayave Kain ni pri ha'adama min chal Adonai. Again, not pri ha'aretz, but pri ha'adama, which is the phrase we use throughout Tanakh. Cain brings from the fruit of the land a gift to God because he's a farmer. Vehevel hevi gamu mechor tzonai chal v'hen. Hevel also brought, he brought a korban, he brought one of the fatters of the sheep. And we all know what happens next. God favors Hevel. We don't know why God favors Hevel. And he doesn't favor Cain, maybe because Cain just brought any stuff and Hevel brought the best stuff. We don't know. Now, we know what happens next. Cain is upset. God tells him it's in your hands, how things are going to play out. Cain then invites Hevel to the field and Cain kills Hevel. Okay. I want to pick it up from after the murder. You can see something very curious happen here. Remember, what happened to Adam after he sinned or whatever it was that happened in the garden? He suddenly had a new relationship with the land, which was one of conflict, but he was still going to work the land. Watch this. Vayomer Adonai al Cain, Ehevel achicha. Famously, God says to Cain, where is Hevel, your brother? And Cain very famously answers back, lo yadati ashomer achi anochi, am I my brother's keeper? And the answer, of course, is yes, you are. Vayomer ma'asita. And of course, God knows the answer to the question and says, what did you do? Called me achicha tzoakim elai. Watch this, min ha'adama. Your brother's blood is calling out from the earth. And again, there's a play on word, which is dam and adama. Adam and adama. Aid and adama. It's all these words, this whole field are kind of working together. Ve'ata arur ata. Now watch. Remember that Adam, the result was Arur Adama. The earth is cursed because of you. Now what happens? Arur Ata Min HaAdama, which can be interpreted two different ways. You are more cursed than the land. I already cursed the land because of what your father did. Now you're more cursed than that. Or Arur Ata Min HaAdama, you're cursed from the land, as if the land won't have anything to do with you. Father worked the land and it was hard. You will not succeed at it. You'll become a dirt farmer. You'll be an Okie in the 30s. Right? Asher patstat pia lakachat dmei achicha miyadecha. The earth that opened up its yaw to take your brother's blood, that earth is now cursed for you. And this, of course, is evoked at the end of Bamidbar. You know, when we said the relevance of this, at the end of Bamidbar, when the Torah talks about allowing a murderer to ransom his life and to get out, Torah says you can't do that because the land becomes defiled, the earth becomes defiled by allowing a murderer to walk through. The innocent blood that was spilled defiles the land without punishing him, which creates the kapara. And then he says, "Ki ta'avod et ha'adama lo tosef teit kochalach." You work the land; it's not going to give you anything. Now notice, Adam, you're going to work the land, but it's going to be hard. And you're going to have bread come from the land, but it's going to be by the sweat of your brow. Now, ki tavor ta adama lo tosef teit kochalach. You work the land, it's not going to give you anything. And the result of that is, na vanad tiyeh ba'aretz. You're going to have to wander. Why are you going to have to wander? It's very simple reality. Because what allows you to stay in one place? is the fact that you can domesticate crops. That's what allows you to stay in one place. Your kind, so you own a huge, as much land as you want. And so you've got whatever you're growing over there, wheat, and you got some vegetables over there, and you got other things you're growing over there, and you can stay in one place, and you can build a family and a home and everything else beautiful. And then you got this growing this season, that growing that season, that growing that season. You have lots of healthy kids who help you in the field, and you can stay put. If the earth will not respond to you at all, you're going to have to move. It's an interesting move because it means that we're moving from farmer to hunter-gatherer, the opposite of the direction that we believe in anthropology and development of human civilization we move, but that's the direction he goes. So you see the difference between Adam and Cain. Adam is told you're going to still be a farmer, but it's going to be hard. Cain, we're told, you're done. You're fired from that. You're going to now have to go and hunt food and go from place to place to find wild things growing and to find animals and whatever it is, although if there are a lot of these animals, it seems that they're not. You have to go find wild stuff. You got to eat. Without, don't eat, you die. And now watch what Cain says. Vayomer Cain el Adonai, gadol avonim minaso. Or better yet, gadol avonim minaso. Cain says, is my sin too big for you to bear? In other words, he's asking for some sort of forgiveness. Hein gerashto ti ayom mi'al pnei ha'adama. Again, you have now exiled me from the face of the earth. What do you mean to exile me? That's called killing. You didn't kill me. What it means is you've exiled me from being anywhere. Because by telling me that the land will no longer respond to me, I can't make a home anywhere. And I'm going to be exiled. Mipanecha esater? Now, the question is this a statement or a rhetorical question? Am I now going to hide from your presence also? Or does it mean I'm driven away from your presence? Vayiti nava nad ba'aretz. So I'm going to be wandering, and here's the problem. Vayachol motzi yahargeni. Now, this is a very difficult passage. Anybody who finds me will kill me. Who's Cain afraid of? His parents are the only other people around. So does it mean other animals? Does it mean he's anticipating more people around? Unclear. But he is speaking to an essential human truth, which is that we all need protection. And somebody who is away from home is inherently unprotected. And somebody who is without any basis, sort of a base, is without protection and can be killed. And nobody will stop them. And so God intervenes, Vayomer lo Adonai, Lachen kol hare Cain shivatayim yukam. Vayasam Adonai Cain, ot vildei akot toko motzo, whatever the mark of Cain is, but some sort of mark on him that says God's protecting him, and if anybody kills him, then that person, then that blood will be avenged seven times over. What does that mean again, and who are these people? Unclear. But watch what Cain does. Vayitzei Cain min lifnei Adonai. Cain leaves the presence of God. Wait a second. He settles. How can he settle? And notice the play on words. He settles in the land of Nod, which is based on Navanad Tiabaretz. The plays on word in this story are phenomenal. So he's supposed to wander and search from place to place. He settles in a place called Nod, which is east of Eden. All right, no nod, it's John Steinbeck that time. And now watch what happens. Vayeda Cain et ishto. And of course, that's a big problem. Where does his wife come from? All right, Chazal, famously, she's his twin. Vatar vatelet et Chanoch. And now what does Cain do? It's phenomenal. They have a son named Chanoch. Vahi boneir. What does Cain do? It seemed that until now there were two choices. You're either a farmer and you stay in whatever relationship with the land responds, or you're a wanderer. You're a gatherer who just finds wild food and you eat it. Cain seems to, on his own, initiate a third approach, which is to build a city. He builds a city, which means that either it means that he's going to now go out every day from the city in a different direction and find wild stuff, or he's going to find other people who work the land and then force them to give him stuff or whatever, but he builds a city. And now starts a tradition that continues for thousands of years, which is naming a city after a child, think Shechem, after a person. Very quickly, we jump ahead several generations till we get to a descendant of Cain whose name is Lamech. And our sense is that they are living in cities because Cain is a bone'er, which means he doesn't build a city, he builds cities. And he builds cities, why? Because cities afford protection for somebody who is not otherwise unprotected, which means what has Cain done with God's sign? Cain has either dropped the sign or else said the sign is not good enough for me. I don't trust it. So he's built his own city. And they've got these cities. Okay. Now look what happens with Lamech. It's a really wild thing. And part of the problem here is that not only does Bereishit usually get only a couple days before we move on to Noach in the Parshat HaShavua, but Bereishit is so filled with so many amazing things that there are tremendous nuggets in Bereishit that we overlook, because they're not part of the star story. Watch what happens here. Vayikach lo Lamech shtei nashim. Lamech takes two wives. Shem achat Ada v'shem hasheni Tzila. Those names themselves are really powerful in the allusions of their names. They both seem to mean warning. Vateled Ada et Yaval. Now Ada gives birth to a child whose name is Yaval. Yaval, the Rishonim say, seems to be related to the word for to bring, to offer things, to be able to bring things. I mean, Yuval Shaila Mora. Hu haya avi yoshev olo miknah. He is the captain of what industry? Of shepherding. Interesting. V'shem achiv Yuval. He's got a brother with a very close name. You'd think these are the only two kids in the world that we know of. There's obviously not more kids. And their parents can only give them Yaval and Yuval. It's like some mean trick. But it's called Yuval. He is the father of all those who play instruments. So the father of shepherds and the father of instruments. What do those two things have in common? Well, they're both what shepherds do. You know, the shepherds are shepherds, and shepherds are the ones who play instruments. It's not unusual. We certainly know it from David, but we understand it from history. And notice that they're both called Yaval Yuval, which sounds an awful lot like Hevel. Let's go back. At the very beginning, Adam has two kids, and right away they operate in the two fields of human endeavor that are critical for ancient man. The field and the animals. Domesticating crops and domesticating animals. Whether animals are going to be used for food, maybe not yet, but they'll be used for wool, they'll be used for milk, they'll be used for other things, and crops. Cain killed Hevel. So what does Cain have to do? Cain has to now be not the farmer, but the wanderer, like a shepherd. And then Cain's descendants have these two kids, and one of them becomes the champion of shepherds. All shepherds say, oh, we're B'nai Yaval. And the other one is the champion of musicians. We're B'nai Yuval. And now watch what happens. Tzila also has a kid. Tzila gam hi yalda et Tuval Cain. What is her kid's name? Tuval, which is like Yaval. Cain, putting both brothers together. And what does this combination of Hevel and Cain do? Lotesh kochoresh nechoshinu varzel. He is the first artisan. Because artisanry is neither one of those. It's a combination of the two, where somebody, it's not a combination in the sense, it's a third thing, but artisanry, taking things and reshaping them. Industry, if you will, is a further step in the evolution of civilization, but it also allows somebody who cannot produce from the land to stay put in the city. So what you see at the end of this whole story is that, in a sense, mankind has readjusted for the reality of the death of Hevel and filled in the blanks. And it's almost as if, by naming these kids Yaval, Yuval, and Tuval Cain, we've kind of brought back that original division of labor and opened up a third field which allows for that. Now, all that is fine. Then the very next thing that happens after these other great apsukim The very next thing that happens is the tablet, the genealogy, is Sefer Toldot Adam, that takes us from Adam all the way to Noach, generation after generation, 10 generations. And then we get this weird story. Now, let's look at the weird story again and see if we can get any more of a sense of what's any sense of what's going on in the story. So they are growing, larov, and they're increasing over the face of the earth. Uvanot yaldu lahem. They had daughters. Now, in the previous chapter, when we skip, there's all that says, yolad banim vanot. They had boys and girls. However, what's the relationship between men and women at the time? Well, we know what the Isha was told. You're going to be subject to your husband. We know that Lemech orders his wives what to do and seems to threaten them with bodily harm if they don't give in to him. And as much as we may not like the picture, there's a lot of things in Tanakh we read which don't thrill us. I'm going to suggest that Vayiru v'neha Elohim et b'nota Adam. B'neha Elohim simply means the men. And they see the b'nota Adam, which means for the first time now there's, shall we call it courting? It's not exactly courting, but it's men choosing their own wives as opposed to somebody who's right in their family, which seems to be the way things were done before this. And what do they see? Kitovotena. Which, by the way, is not necessarily a bad thing for two people to make that choice. Now here, only one's making the choice. Vayikhu lahem nashim, yikol asher bacharu. But the men saw women, and they liked them, and they chose them. Now, vayomer Adonai lo yadon ruchi va'adam leolam. This is the tip of the hard part. Bishagam hu vasar. Now, bishagam is a tricky word. The classic way of reading it is bishagam. In that also, hubasar, meaning it's also flesh. The problem is that the prefix shin is much later in Tanakh than Bereshit. It's a late biblical use. In early Tanakh, we'd use the word asher, and we'd say ba'asher hubasar. Bishagam hubasar is difficult. So one other suggestion that I think Shadal entertains, that he doesn't like, is that bishagam is bishagagam. The Gimel has a dagesh in it, and the idea is that which leads them astray is their flesh. In other words, it's their desire for the flesh that leads them astray and leads them to make these choices. But is this necessarily a bad thing? Unclear. But what he does say is, Vayu yamav me'av esrim shana. He will live to 120 years. That's it. Now, who is it? And again, I'm standing at Har Sinai. Or better yet, I'm standing in Arvot Moav as Moshe finishes the Torah and hands it over. And who do I know of who's living 120 years? There's only one person. Avram lived more than that. Yitzhak lived more than that. Yosef lived less than that. There's only one famous 120. There's others in the Midrash, but in Tanakh, there's one famous 120, and that's Moshe. But look at the last pasuk in Source 5. Hanefilim hayu v'aretz bayimim ahem. Now, who are these Nephilim? These are monsters. Who are these monsters? When these B'nei HaElohim, which means we're describing people, humans, men, as B'nei HaElohim. And I know it sounds strange, but stay with me for a couple minutes and I'll try to support it. That these men, when they had relations with women, gave birth to these huge monsters, these terrifying enemies, these Nephilim. So, again, why is this story here at all? What's the relevance? So, I want to take you to the scene in Arvot Moav, the banks of the Jordan. We're about to cross over the Jordan, we're about to enter the land, and we're about to go to war. And we're confident, you got Yoshua with us, but we've also heard stories from our parents. And what are the stories we heard from our parents? Well, we heard the story from our parents about why we're the ones going in and they didn't. Why didn't they go in? Because 38 years ago, 12 guys went to Israel and came back and some of them gave a report about the land. And what did they say in that report? Please take a look in source 7. Vayotziu dibat haaretz asher taru ota b'nei Yisrael lemor. They blasphemed the land. Haaretz asher avarnu v'alatur ota eretz ochel yoshveah hi v'chol ha'am asher ra'inu v'tocha anshei midot. All the people we saw there are huge. V'sham ra'inu etan nefilim. We saw the nefilim. This is the other mention of the nefilim in Chumash. This and ours. Okay. And they come back and everybody's scared and everybody's frightened. As a result, everybody says, we don't want to go to the land and let's appoint a different leader. Last pasuk in 7, but nitna rosh v'nashuva mitzrayma. And what does Moshe tell the new generation before he's about to die? Gam b'itana afadu nabigalchem l'mora k'matel lo tovosham. You know the reason I'm not going to the land is because of chetam raglim. That's what Moshe himself says. He doesn't tell about the rock. He says, because the rock just happened, he says, because of that happened then, I couldn't go into the land. The decree included everything, including me. That's Moshe's own words. Let's think about what that means. Moshe isn't going into the land, and what's the result of that? So what is Moshe himself called? First of all, when Moshe gives his bracha to Bnei Yisrael, what's he called in source 11? Zota bracha shebarach Moshe, ish ha-Elohim. But even stronger than that, all the way back in Mitzrayim, when Hashem appoints Moshe to go to Paro, he says, Re'ein etaticha Elohim lefaro. Moshe, you are an Elohim to Paro, and Aaron is your prophet. You're a lord over Paro. Moshe is an Isha Elohim. Moshe is described as an Elohim. Let's go back to our story in Source 5. Beneha Elohim are these mighty people who, by the way, God says, I'm limiting their life to 120 years. And they were such mighty people that when they had relations, the result were Nephilim. And now here I am in Arvot Moav, and I finally hear this story. And what do I suddenly realize? Had we allowed Moshe to lead us into the land, we wouldn't have been afraid of Nephilim. Because Moshe is like one of these Bnei HaElohim. The Moshe that we have had with us that we're saying goodbye to is like one of these Bnei HaElohim from Bereishit. 120 years. And therefore, he could have easily, the Nephilim would have been nothing for him. The Nephilim were his own, Ki'ilu, his own offspring. Not really, but Ki'ilu, his own offspring. So we understand why this story here in Source 5, this very bizarre story, is so critical for us at this juncture. Had we stuck with Moshe Rabbeinu, had our parents had the faith and said, we don't care what you 10 guys are saying, we're going in, Moshe's going to lead us in, it would have been a landslide. It would have been very simple. We would have had nothing to be afraid of. And now we can understand what Chazal say, Moshe min haTorah min ha'ayin, Bishagam Hubasar. When Chazal make this very strange question, where do we know Moshe from the Torah? They're hinting to where do we find Moshe before Moshe shows up? Just like where do we find Esther before Esther shows up? Where do we find Haman before Haman shows up? Where do we find Moshe before Moshe shows up? And the answer is Moshe shows up in this story because Moshe is the Isha Elohim who is compared to these Bnei Elohim. And that's why God says here, he will live 120 years. What does Moshe say in his farewell speech to Bnei Israel? Ben me'av esrim shana anochi hayom. Lo'uchal od latzeit v'lavo. I'm 120, I can no longer fight. I could, but God said I can't. So the decree is there. And so this very strange story at the very beginning of Bereishit brings us all the way to the very end of the Torah and says, that's why it's important for us to hear this story, to understand we had an amazing leader that had we allowed him to lead us into the land, it would have been a slam dunk. We blew it. And perhaps that's a powerful lesson for us to always treasure the leaders that we have when they are able to do things and not always be looking for something else. I don't know. I don't want to take this into necessarily into that direction, but I think that's the significance of the story here.